reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
I'm Haley.
I'm Hope.
I'm Hannah.
We're from Georgia, and we like KUCI
in Irvine.
Peace!
Today, in a world of sound bites and constant visual stimulation telling us how to look, act, talk, and feel, we have lost our ability to connect. Instead of focusing on what celebrities are doing as if they were our acquaintances, maybe we can look more to each other to emulate and learn from. Join us Friday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Peace by Peace, where we discuss issues that affect our peace, peace of humanity, and peace in our time.
And this is 88.9 FM KUCI, and this is Tani Tuduviel sitting in today for Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Writers on Writing. And today my guest is going to be Dr. Amy Sturgis, who is an author, speaker, instructor, and scholar of science fiction, fantasy, and Native American studies. And Dr. Sturgis, are you there?
Yes, I am, Tani. Thank you so much for having me with you today.
Thank you so much for coming on. I am so excited about this, and I'm so excited for anyone who may be listening today, just because I have had so much fun just talking to you before, and the things that you are involved in doing are just so fascinating to me. For our listeners, I am the resident elf here at KUCI, and I host a radio show on public affairs show on Friday mornings called What Would Arwen Do, which is a Middle Earth elf's perspective on life, community, and the arts. So I'm always interested in talking to other people who are involved in the, not only the Tolkien community, but just in the area of fantasy and science fiction writing, and just because of all the wonderful things that I think that provides to those of us who like to have a rich, imaginative life. And Amy, I just thank you so much for the contribution that you make to that. You teach where? Okay, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about kind of your background, where you teach, and what you teach?
Absolutely, I teach at Belmont University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I also, in the summers, teach, or have for the last several years, and will this summer teach for the Institute for Humane Studies, which has special seminars in different places in the country. I'll be teaching at Princeton University this summer for them. And as you mentioned before, I teach science fiction and fantasy studies as well as Native American studies. I'm at Belmont in the interdisciplinary studies area, which allows me to do all sorts of interesting combinations that I really enjoy, such as teaching 20th century history through science fiction, getting to connect history and literature and law and history, and bringing in literature as historical texts and all kinds of good stuff.
That is so fascinating. I wish I could move there just so that I could come and sit in your classes and, and just hear of this, because it just is so fascinating to me. What an interesting, just the way that all those things kind of fit together. When I was reading about some of your books, and even about, I was looking on your website. And what is your website address, just for our listeners, in case they want to get more information?
Thank you. That's www.amyhsturgis, that's spelled STURGIS.com. And Amy H. Sturgis is all one word.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at, I was looking at all kinds of things. But one of the things that I noticed is, on the page about your education, it says you have a PhD in intellectual history.
Yes.
And that you did your dissertation, now I can't pronounce that word, from
Aniyawiya to Indian Territory. It's Concepts of Cherokee Civilization. Aniyawiya is one of the terms that the Cherokees, Tsalagi, as real name of that nation, call themselves, meaning the first people, the primary people.
Wow.
And so that work was specifically on the constitutional thought of the Cherokee Nation.
Wow. Kind of like the elves in Middle Earth.
Exactly. Well, the Cherokees have a legend of an immortal people as well that has lots of similarities with the elves. So there's a lovely area there of affinity between the two.
Uh-huh. And I noticed on this also, it says that you passed a Cherokee language exam with fluency. You speak Cherokee?
Not terribly well, no. I do read and write it to some degree. I did much better a few years ago than I do now, but I've brought that back out a bit. I'm finishing now a book on the Trail of Tears and Indian removal for Greenwood Press, and so I'm revisiting some of that quite a bit. But most of my work was written, I'm afraid. But that was definitely something that meant a lot to my work and a lot to me personally.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing how much language opens up worldviews and opens up an understanding of a moment in time and of a mindset and of things. It really allows access to ideas that you simply cannot have when you're making translations.
Wow. Well, you are working on some incredible projects this year, and I want to ask you about some of those, specifically about the Magic Ring. But I'd like to hear just a little bit more about this book. You say it's coming out the end of this year. It's called The Trail of Tears and Indian Removal.
Yes.
Could you just tell us a little bit about that? It sounds incredible.
Oh, thank you. That will be with Greenwood Press,
uh-huh.
And there are a number of very excellent books about the process by which the Cherokee Nation, in particular, the five southeastern tribes all together, the Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, Creeks, Seminoles, were moved from the east west of the Mississippi during the Jackson and Van Buren administrations, and dealing with everything from geography to politics to that sort of thing. What I really wanted to accomplish in my book was an intellectual history of a history of ideas of the different sides that were involved. So, in other words, looking at how, from the U.S. standpoint, what changes had to happen in the way U.S. citizens and U.S. leadership saw U.S. processes in order to go from Jefferson's understanding of what American Indian policy should be, would move to what Jackson's idea would be, which would then ultimately enable what really is a policy of ethnic cleansing that happened in U.S. history. And on the other side, I was very interested in looking at the Cherokee Nation's intellectual history, how they viewed their civilization, how they viewed the acculturation that was taking place between the Cherokee Nation and the U.S., and also what violence removal did to their institutions, their constitution, to their leadership patterns. It was much more than just losing over 25% of their people.
Yes.
It was a great upheaval in their political and social and intellectual systems that they had to reforge and build again when they reached so-called Indian Territory, which is today the state of Oklahoma, my original home state. And so I'm trying to look at the ideas and the dialogues that took place and really treating both sides as in depth as possible in looking at their institutions and their ideas.
Wow.
And also asking the larger questions of how could this have happened? How can we make sure that something like this doesn't happen again?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer to that is in these ideas more than in the specifics that have been dealt with so very ably by other historians.
Yes. Well, wow, that sounds incredible. And I will certainly want to be getting my hands on that. I do have a bit of Indian blood in me, and I've always felt that the story of, the Indians' story in the history of America is, to me, one of the great tragedies of our history. It always seems to kind of be in the background, but it never seems to come too much into the foreground. And
very true.
Yeah. And so I'm hoping when that comes out that perhaps you might come on to, and I could talk to you again sometime on my What Would Arwen Do show.
Oh, I would love that.
I would absolutely love to explore some of those ideas for our listeners as well. So, wow. Okay, well, can we switch gears here just a little bit?
Absolutely. I'm all about switching gears.
Yes, well, because you have such interesting projects going on. I just love this stuff. There's part of like, oh gosh, I'm not even sure let's jump into just to make sure that we have enough time. To talk about the book, The Magic Ring.
Yes. Can
you just, for our readers, for our listeners, can you just maybe talk a little bit about what it is, about even, and just what the connection would be with regards to J.R. Tolkien's work, you know, and the fact that he wrote a book about the Lord of the Ring. Can we just kind of go there for a little while?
Certainly, it would be my pleasure.
Before we jump into that, I just do want to say that in case someone's just tuning in, this is Tani Tenuviel, the resident elf here at QCI, sitting in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett today on Writers on Writing with my guest, Dr. Amy Sturgis. And we're going to be talking about the book, The Magic Ring. And if you're interested in any things hobbitish or Tolkienish, then please stay with us. I want to hear about this Magic Ring book. I am so intrigued by this.
Oh, thank you. I'm extremely excited about the project. I'm working with Valancourt Books, who are a fantastic press that basically looks back and finds and rescues great Gothic literature from the 18th and 19th centuries that have been lost, that have not been published in many years, and makes them available again to the reading public. And I was brought in for this particular project, which is, as you said, The Magic Ring, by the Baron de La Motte Fouqué, who was a German writer in the 19th century. He wrote fantasy and Gothic fiction. He was very interested with concerns of chivalry, beauty, and death, and spirituality. A lot of his works are intensely, beautifully wrought, but they always have this flavor of melancholy that sort of sets them apart. Very elvish, if you would.
yes.
He's probably best known to English readers by his work Undine, which is a story of a water sprite who comes to live among humans and marries a human in order to have a soul. But when her husband casts her aside, she goes back to live in the water. And by the rule that governs the water sprites and humanity, when he is unfaithful to her, then she's required to come back into the world of humanity and kill him. So it's a tragedy. It's almost a kind of supernatural Romeo and Juliet story.
Wow.
But at any rate, The Magic Ring is an absolutely remarkable book. It's just a beautiful story. It was first written in 1813 in German, and then was first translated into English in 1826. And that particular translation was beautiful. It was written by, translated by one of the Romantic poets who was sort of on the second or third level out from the whole Byron-Shelley group, named Robert Pierce Gillies. And he did an exceptional job of not only translating the ideas, but making it in English as beautiful as it was in German.
Wow.
It went through a couple of other translations. The last time that it was translated and published in English was in 1876, which means our publication, which will come out later this year, will be the first since 1876 for English readers. And we're restoring the original Romantic Gillies translation, which remarkably reads like fantastic fantasy novel today.
Really?
It immediately draws you in. It's the flow of the language is just enthralling. And so I'm going to be doing a long introduction to explain why it's such an important work, because it's sort of a missing link, in a way, between the old Germanic myths and the old Norse myths and the Siegfried legend, which went back many hundreds of years, and the work first of Wagner's Ring Cycle and then of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. The story of the Magic Ring is about a man who goes on a quest to find a magic ring, which gives special powers to whoever possesses it, and it can only be destroyed by being thrown into fire. Sounds familiar?
Sounds a little familiar.
And it's drawing on the same building blocks that Tolkien used, and there's actually a way to connect all of the dots and see that Tolkien was aware of this work. And so this is one of the ancestor texts, one of the predecessors, and it's in every way as absorbing and as epic as all of those early legends that informed these great texts would require. So I'm really excited about seeing this back in the hands of the reading public again.
I'm very excited that you are writing the introduction to that.
That's
just going to, I mean, I'm excited to get my hands on it, but I'm going to be very excited also just to read your introduction, just partly because I've read some of your other things, which I will comment on a little bit later, of articles where you kind of comment on and tie these things together. And I was just so totally enchanted that I am very excited to hear just your introduction. Is it going to be more than just a couple of pages, I hope?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's looking to be quite a work in itself.
Oh,
in
wonderful.
Terms of length. I'm also looking to, and I'm in the process right now of going through and making notes from the text that will be, end notes that will help tie the text together. Because the other interesting thing that the author does is, although the work is deeply magical and deeply fantastical, he blends that almost seamlessly with a real geographic place and a real historical time.
Oh, really?
So it's Richard II is king, and they're going on crusades, and, X here on the map is where our characters are, and
yet
they're also involved in this completely fantastical world. And so I'm hoping that we can, add these notes and make things a little more elaborated upon for the readers, just to get all of the bang for every lovely detail that he has in there, so we can sort of do some tracing of places and tracing of times and tracing of particular references that are made without interrupting the text. But for those who are interested, we can take that a little bit further.
Yes. Oh, I love that stuff. In fact, I find myself. I love a lot of times reading all around things, like in fact, this morning I just spent some time in the book J.R. Tolkien's Letters, which I absolutely love. And it's one of those things, too, that I don't read it from front to back. I just pick it up and munch through it, because I feel like if I ever read it from front to back, then I'll know that I've actually gotten all of it.
And
I don't want to have all of it. I want to know that I still have some joy of discovery at some point. And and it's so funny, because I was actually reading today in a letter 164 where he was talking about the Hobbit, but he mentioned something about the ring that I thought was interesting. Let's see, it was really given and present in germ from the beginning. It is really given and present in germ from the beginning, though I had no conscious notion of what the necromancer stood for, except ever-recurrent evil in the Hobbit, nor of his connection with the ring. But if you wanted to go on from the end of the Hobbit, I think the ring would be your inevitable choice as the link. Then you would want a large tale, the ring would at once acquire a capital letter and the Dark Lord would immediately appear. And he goes on to say, as he did, unasked, on the hearth at Bag End as soon as I came to that point. And this is a wonderful letter, actually, because he goes on to talk about how there were certain things that he knew were going to show up and certain things that he just discovered. Like he says, so the essential quest started at once, but I met a lot of things on the way that astonished me. Tom Bombadil I knew already, but I had never been to Bree. Strider sitting in the corner at the end was a shock, and I had no more idea who he was than had Frodo. The Mines of Moria had been a mere name, and of Lothlorien no word had reached my mortal ears till I came there. Far away I knew there were the Horse Lords on the confines of the ancient kingdom of men, but Fangorn Forest was an unforeseen adventure. I had never heard of the House of Eorl, nor of the Stewards of Gondor. Most disquieting of all, Saruman had never been revealed to me, and I was as mystified as Frodo at Gandalf's failure to appear on September 22nd. And so it's interesting because he also talks sometimes about how, you know, these things, undoubtedly some of the things of his childhood probably influenced his writing and his stories, and yet some things he feels like just kind of like popped out of air. He has no idea where they came from.
I really love that humility that he has, where he talks about his writing more in terms of discovery than of architecture. He's not building something. He's being enlightened, and he's discovering it along the way. Isn't that fantastic?
It is, and that is one of the things I do love about his letters. Every once in a while, he always says a lot of times he prefaces his letters or opens his letters with such a humble, like even on this one. This is from a letter to Dr. Auden in 1955. I was very pleased to hear from you and glad to feel that you were not bored. I am afraid that you may be in for a rather long letter again, but you can do what you like with it. I type it so that it may be at any rate that it may at any rate be quickly readable. I do not really think that I'm frightfully important. I wrote the trilogy as a personal satisfaction given to it by the scarcity of literature of the sort that I wanted to read. He says, a great labor, and as the author of the Ancrene says at the end of his book, I would rather, God be my witness, set out on foot for Rome than begin the work over again. But I love his humility, because he's always saying little things like, I do not really think that I am frightfully important. And I think that comes across so much in just the presentation of his work. You know, it is as though he's just like discovering it.
Yes.
So when is this wonderful book, The Magic Ring, when can we expect to see that perhaps in bookstores?
Let's see. We're aiming for July. And that will be available not only through Valancourt Press, which, by the way, there's a link to the press, Valancourt Books, from my website, but they'll also be available through Amazon.com and all mainstream booksellers in that way.
And tell us your website address again, please.
That's at www.amyhsturgis.com, and that's S-T-U-R-G-I-S for Sturgis.
Uh-huh. And are you by any chance going to be doing a little, any book signings or book tour or anything with that?
Well, I know we will. I will be signing. One of the reasons we wanted to have it out in July is the very beginning of August is the annual meeting of the Mythopoeic Society, which is the scholarly and interested reader friendly organization for the study of J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and Inklings and Mythopoeic literature. So that includes all fantasy literature. There'll be the annual meeting in August, and actually this year I will be the scholar guest of honor, and the subject matter for the theme for this year's meeting is the intersection of fantasy literature and Native American literature.
Oh, my goodness. I have to go to that this year. Where is it going to be held?
Wonderful. That will be at the University of Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma.
Oh.
And I'm very excited about it. And I know there will be a book signing then. And I usually speak at somewhere between 6 and 8 conventions a year, and I do intend to have some of the books with me wherever I roam, which will be also on my website. So I definitely would love to do that and to make this work available in any way that I could.
And you're going to be also at the big event in the Gathering of the Fellowship, is
yes.
that correct? And gosh, that's in is that in August?
That's in July. I believe that's July. Is that 1st through 4th?
Oh my goodness! I was thinking it was later in the summer. I need to. Yeah, that. So, will the book be available by then? Perhaps not.
Ideally, it will. I'm mm-hmm. not quite sure it will.
Right.
The August was the first really hard date that we had. But in a perfect world, and I'm working on it,
mm-hmm.
We would have it ready for the gathering. I know
right.
that's going to be an amazing event, and so nice. Everything fell together beautifully. The first gathering was remarkable.
Yes, you were there.
Yes.
I was there, too. I didn't get to meet you, but that was one of the highlight adventures of my life.
It was wonderful.
Wasn't it incredible?
This time, it corresponds with The Lord of the Rings, the musical that's being held in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
Along with all the mini guests and everything else that will be going on. So I think if we loved the first one, and we did, the second one will be even more amazing.
It was so fun. I'm not kidding. That one corresponded to the premiere of The Return of the King.
Yes.
And there were those crazy ones of us that actually went and sat through all three of the films in the theater one day, extended versions, for The Return of the King. But the thing that was so wonderful for me is that, I have fallen in love with J.R. Tolkien's works, both the movies. The movies introduced me to his works. But also I just love the movies, and I met the most incredible community of people, and most of the people that I knew I had met online, because I just couldn't find people in my neighborhood and in my small circles that were quite as crazy about these things as I was.
Right.
And so I had become part of an online community, which is actually, I think, Tolkien Online, in case anyone's interested in that. And I had literally just probably 100 people that I would talk to online all the time over the years. We'd discuss the movies, we'd discuss the books, we'd write our own role play stories. And at that first gathering, I got to meet people from England, Wales, New Zealand, East Coast, just from all France, from all over the globe. We all just kind of converged on Toronto,
yeah.
And it was so incredible. And the other thing that was so fun was going down into the lobby, and it's like the entire hotel was just full of hobbits and wizards and elves, because we're all a bunch of crazy costuming fanatics. And it was such a crack up to go into the lobby and just see hobbits and elves and wizards lounging around in the lobby.
Exactly. And they had done such a beautiful job of organizing everything.
I remember yes.
the scholarly track, which is where I gave my talks, was
mm-hmm.
made up to look like Bag End.
Mm-hmm.
So the stage was literally the foyer of Bilbo's hobbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the little round windows in the back, and it had the little rug and the chairs and just the attention to detail.
It was incredible.
Amazing.
And for anyone who's interested in something like that, any area of Tolkien interest that you would have, you could get completely satisfied there. Whether it was costuming, they had a complete costuming track for people that wanted to know how to build costumes, make costumes, put on prosthetics, make your own prosthetics. Then they had the artist track, which, not only incredible
yeah.
artists like Ted Naismith, who was actually there with his art, giving slide presentations and showing some art that hasn't even made it into some of the books yet, but also lots of art from just really great independent artists that love to illustrate things relating to Tolkien. And then the scholar track, and then fun things. They had like shows all day. They had stars there. It was so fun to get to just hang out with Bruce, the guy that played, I'm so bad. I'm so not into the stars.
Gamling. from the film.
Yes, yes, Gambling and Haldir, the guy that played Haldir, were there. And so they just had great shows. Oh, and then did you get to go to the thing that they had at Medieval Times?
Oh, yes. That was
They
phenomenal.
Transformed Medieval Times into Middle Earth. And all the knights that had actually the shields and banners of Lothlorien, Gondor, was that incredible?
That was remarkable. And the concert afterwards with Glass Hammer, who mm-hmm. also came in November and played for our C.S. Lewis conference, which we had at Belmont University, a fantastic band, all that night in full costume, playing all of their Middle Earth tunes. It was just truly a remarkable evening and a remarkable event. And again, all these people brought together originally from books.
Yes.
If the books hadn't been there, nothing else would have.
Nothing would have been there. And what is so wonderful, too, is that even all the people who love the movies completely concede that. I mean, all of us, I know for myself, I loved the movies, but to me they were a completely different art form. And then transitioning into the books, it was just like going from one level of bliss to a bigger level of bliss.
Right. Exactly.
So, yes. And so, and even just all the extraneous things, like even just, the interest that comes for things like the magic ring, things, you know, the people who are interested in Tolkien, it seems that, you know, I know for me, I became interested in other things as well, you know, and had a great appreciation for mm-hmm. other types of fantasy literature and the things that were the precursors to those things. And it's just, to me, it's just all good at all. Just enriches our minds and imaginations so much.
Exactly. There's such a demand now for scholarship, which is not something that always has that tremendous of a demand. Now there's this great push. Some fantastic scholars are going into fantasy studies, Gothic studies, medieval studies, all tied around these texts. Mm-hmm. And it makes things like what Valancourt Books is doing, the idea of bringing the magic ring back, it makes it viable mm-hmm. because there's a readership there and there's interested people there. The reason I get to teach my Tolkien course and my Harry Potter course and many other courses related to these texts is because people are already interested. It's not something you have to persuade people into giving a chance. People are already there and are hungry for it, and that's just a fantastic place for any writer or any scholar to be. The audience is already there.
Yes. And speaking of Harry Potter, the talk that you did at the One Ring Celebration back in January had to do with the issue of readership, having, you know, with Harry Potter and J.R.R. Tolkien. And it was kind of taken from an essay that you did called Harry Potter is a Hobbit, Rowling, Tolkien, and the Question of Readership. Is that essay still available online? Do you know?
It absolutely is. If you go to my website, it's available there, and it's also available on the website HogwartsProfessor.com. Mm-hmm. My friend and good scholar, John Granger, who also works with Harry Potter studies, kindly has hosted that as well. So it's available in both of those places. And that's thanks to the kind permission of the editor of CSL, which is the Bulletin of the New York C.S. Lewis Society, which is the publication that first made that essay available.
I love it. It just explores this whole, it's not just about, you know, readership of Harry Potter and Tolkien and things. I love this essay because it's really about, fantasy literature and what is its relevance? Who is it for? You know, is it just escapism, or does it really provide something that I believe our souls need, you know, and something that enriches and expands our imagination, that enriches, I think, the way that we are in the world, you know, that
couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And I love this essay. And in fact, you know, I just realized too, because I had forgotten, because we did an interview about that about that essay and the topic of readership. And that is actually on our KUCI website still. So if someone's interested in hearing that interview that I did with Dr. Sturgis back in January, mm-hmm. if they want to go to the KUCI Talk, it's KUCITalk.org. That's our public affairs website here at KUCI. And in the left column, there are podcasts because we podcast our shows, and there is that interview. And it's under my show, What Would Arwen Do? And if you just kind of scroll down on the left-hand side there, you'll see What Would Arwen Do? An interview with Amy H. Sturgis about the published article, Harry Potter is a Hobbit. So I hope people will perhaps listen to that if they're not you know, into... if they don't have time to read too much, but also just to read this essay. This is just a great essay. It's one of those things that as I was reading it, I could just feel my soul being nourished. It was like fresh, cool rain, you know, just, I don't know. I just loved
it. Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate that. Well, I feel very strongly that these issues are important, and I sometimes am met with raised eyebrows when I say I do history and I do science fiction and fantasy, and people look at me as if, you know, I've got some sort of intellectual schizophrenia. And I say, actually, I see there's an area where all of this ties together, and it's incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Both the historical profession, the historians and those with historical training, and those who read science fiction and its related genres of, you know, fantasy and horror and what used to be called weird fiction, which mm-hmm. is really ties all three together as speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. Both are asking the same question, and that is, what does it mean to be human? One just happens to look backwards, and one looks forwards mm-hmm. to answer that question, or looks in a completely different direction of the imagination. But at the heart of all of that is the fundamental question of what it means to be human. And if we understand that, then we can move on to questions such as, how do we treat each other? How do we treat the world we live in? What is the good life? What is good and what is bad? What is evil? What is right? Mm-hmm. All of those things come out of understanding our relationship to each other, to our environment, to our Creator. All come from first thinking about what it means to be us, and all of the great opportunities and responsibilities that come with being human. And I think all of those different lenses, all of those different windows into that question really complement each other very well.
Mm-hmm. And I love that science fiction, fantasy, are, you know, J.R. Tolkien's works, to me, I mean, those things expand my ability to, I think, to think about them in ways that I can't always access just by the black and white concrete things that happen every single day. You know, I think
right.
I think metaphor and you know, even allegory, but you know, those things, I think they broaden, you know, the use of our imagination makes the world more real, not more fantastical. If that
precisely.
Makes any sense.
And yeah. It allows us to get just enough distance from very personal questions we're asking about ourselves to be able to really find some answers, I think. I just finished a piece that came out in December in Apex Science Fiction and Horror Digest that's about what I'm calling the Tolkien-Lovecraft connection, looking at the relationship between the works of H.P. Lovecraft, another author I love.
And you know, I saw that on your website, and I must confess my ignorance here, because I thought, what an interesting name, and I thought, I don't know, I'm not familiar with that. And but I looked online just real briefly before I came and read a little bit about the bio about him, and I thought, oh my goodness, I want to get my hands on some of this man's works.
It's simply astounding. And
because he was kind of in the same time period as, like, say, G.K. Chesterton?
Exactly, yes. And was only born 2 years apart from Tolkien himself. Now, he didn't live terribly long, and unfortunately, he died in the same year that Tolkien's works really took off, the same year that The Hobbit was first published.
Mm-hmm.
But for men born only 2 years apart, they were contemporaries in a number of ways and drew inspiration from many of the same people, including Lord Dunsany and some of the great fantasists. Lovecraft was coming from a very different worldview, but it seems to me that although he provides answers that I know Tolkien wouldn't agree with personally, I think they're both asking the same questions, mm-hmm. which is what my essay was about. And I find it interesting that I'm drawn so much to two writers who are saying such different things. And then it occurred to me that it's not really in the answers they're providing as much as the fact that they're both valuing the same questions.
Right.
And they're seeing that these issues are important. And his ability to take leaps of imagination are also just remarkable. He was a pioneering writer that allowed for all kinds of writers to follow in both horror and science fiction.
Mm.
And he also was, in the same way Tolkien was, a scholar of his genre, very self-aware of what he was doing. And so just as Tolkien wrote on fairy stories to kind of defend the work he wanted to write,
mm-hmm.
H.P. Lovecraft wrote the supernatural horror in literature. A really
is that
seminal
the name
essay.
Of the book? Was that the name of the book?
Yes. Uh-huh.
The Supernatural Horror?
In literature, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now out, I think, in an annotated version that's just incredibly useful for anyone who's interested in the development of the genre. And the fact that there are so many common references between the two of inspirations is just a remarkable time. And you're quite right. Chesterton is writing in the same vein as well,
mm-hmm.
at the same time period.
And
the fact that you can talk about questions of the relationship, the individual to the community, the individual to different institutions, just fundamental questions of how we organize ourselves.
Yes.
And yet
yes.
we can look at these kinds of issues, modernity. What modernity means? Do we really want to be modern? If being modern,
the Napoleon of Notting Hill by G.K. Chesterton. Oh my goodness!
Yes, exactly.
That little story was it was one of those things that I just took I think I was sick or something, and I just read it over a few days, it's a wonderful little story, and yet it raises so many questions about who we are in the world. What is it about these things that we develop as, these systems or ideologies or whatever as human beings? Are they good? Are they bad? Do they serve us? Do they serve others? And, but you get to look at them in a completely different way than just asking those, questions, just blatantly like that.
Right. I sometimes watching CNN or Fox News or one of the news sources, C-SPAN, I think that I'd like to take all of the people who are in the roundtable discussion and give them a couple of short stories and
right.
then have them come back and see if their answers are any different or if they can frame their questions in a slightly different way. Because I read the news and I think there's an awful lot that's going on in our world today that is directly relevant to the things that these great authors were writing about.
Oh, absolutely. Just for those listening, this is 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, and this is Tani Tanuviel sitting in today for Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Writers on Writing with my guest, Dr. Amy Sturgis. And, we just have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and there's so much I want to cover. Can we talk a little bit about this thing that you have coming out, and this is completely switching gears. There's a book chapter called
yes.
Sexy Nerds, Ilya Kuryakin, Mr. Spock, and the Image of the Cerebral Hero in Television Drama. What is that all about?
Have I got a great job or what?
You absolutely have a great job. So I hope that anybody out there who has a heart to be a writer will not lose hope because you are living it and doing it.
If I told my students, if you want to get away with writing articles about sexy nerds, there is a place for you in this world.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a project that's been several years in the making, just an absolute joy. I worked with my colleague, Dr. Cynthia Walker, who's at St. Peter's College mm-hmm. in Media Studies, and it's going to be out in a few short months in the book Common Sense, Intelligence as Presented in Popular Television. With Lexington Books, and it's a scholarly volume with all sorts of essays on different topics. Some are very specialized, dealing with, one character in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and then some are very broad and theoretical. And ours is sort of a history where we look at the development of the sexy nerd as a sort of archetype.
Yeah.
The idea, the broad...
How did we ever get to the idea where... Harry Potter is like way cool, and even like the guy that was in Spider-Man. I mean, these are nerdy guys.
With the little round frame glasses and everything.
Yeah,
perfect stereotype. Our argument is that there's a connection, some sort of connection between leaps in education, particularly in the sciences, and leaps with. A certain sort of critical mass of the population being comfortable with a new kind of technology, whether it was cell phones or desk computers or laptops or whatever, with these new characters that come out. And we see them start as secondary characters, backup characters.
Mm-hmm.
Really, if you want to go to cerebral, sexy heroes, the first great one is Sherlock Holmes coming out of the Industrial Revolution. But if you want to look at TV, several publications at the time said that The Man from U.N.C.L.E.'s Ilya Kuryakin was the first.
Yeah.
And very short.
I had a crush on him. I just dated myself.
And he's David McCallum is still, I guess it's NCIS where he's starring now. Mid-70s and still going strong and still has quite a ladies fan base there.
Mm-hmm.
But just a few months later then Mr. Spock comes along. But they were always sort of the sidekick mm-hmm. at that point and for a number of years on. But we sort of trace the development through sort of the nerd gone bad of Avon and Blake Seven. Through to when the nerd actually moves beyond the sidekick status and becomes the leading man with someone like Fox Mulder in The X-Files,
mm-hmm.
And looked at the phenomenon of the way nerds are treated by, for example, Joss Whedon in his series, whether that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Angel or my personal favorite, Serenity and the TV series that the film was based on, Firefly, looking at the way nerds now also, if you look at the way the Star Trek franchise developed, the sexy nerds ended up being the women and not the men. So you have the guy sexy nerd sidekick developing into either the lead man or the leading lady. And so we have lots of fun with sort of tracing the way that developed and all sorts of interesting blasts from the past in there from MacGyver.
Oh, that's going to be so fun.
All sorts of good things, but also trying to find some correlations between the times we see these characters coming out. And most of them, with a few exceptions, seem to be surprises even to the people who made them. They didn't realize this character was going to be the one that really captured the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some great, or we got some great responses in interviews from fans who were involved with the different universes described.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly women talking about why they found these characters sexy and the fact that they said they could do the things, they could read the books, they could work with the computers, they could be antisocial and sarcastic and dark and all the things that they wanted to be and couldn't socially be, they see these characters getting to be, and they found them very lovable for that. And I think there's some really interesting dynamics going on there socially and psychologically with, why, still today, Ilya Kuryakin and Mrs. Right. Spock are hot.
Oh, gosh.
We love them for their minds.
Oh, yes, we do.
Sure, we do. Thing too, perhaps. But there's some really interesting things there with the development of technology, these characters.
Yeah. Oh, Dr. Sturgis, Amy, thank you so much for being on the show today. And I am very sad to announce that our time is up.
It moves so quickly when I get to talk with you. I have so much fun. Thank you for the invitation to talk with you this evening.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's so funny because I was just thinking about this. And again, this is just, I just want to say as an encouragement to anyone who thinks they may have an article or a book or anything in them that they would like to write. This morning, I was thinking as I was getting ready for my show today and tomorrow, and I was reading through J.R. Tolkien's letters, and I was looking for this particular letter, and then I was looking for something in the Silmarillion, and I thought, how wonderful is this work that I get to do on the radio show? I mean, my work to prepare for it is spending time in the things that I love to spend the most time in. I mean, how wonderful is that? And it seems to me, that the work that you do is, I mean, how fun it must have been doing the research for Sexy Nerds.
Ah, well, I had lived that research for years myself, you know. But it's just a blessing. And other things I do, for instance, I have a column at Pop Thought. Wanted to throw that out there.
Oh, yes.
PopThought.com. The Attack of the 5'2" Woman is my column. And on a monthly basis, I get to talk about the things I'm reading and watching and thinking about. It's fantastic. It's really play. It's mind candy.
Yes.
And it allows, allows us never to grow up.
Yes.
But at the same time, talk about things that are incredibly important and serious. So it's just fantastic. We're both very blessed people.
Absolutely. And it's nice to be able to talk about these things that are of great importance with a certain amount of lightness so that we can, it's safe to go there and to spend time with them. So Dr. Sturgis, again, I want to thank you ever so much for being with me here today. And so until we meet again, Ellen Salalumen Omentielvo, my friend, and let's talk soon.
Oh, thank you so much, Namarie.
You're welcome. Oh, and tell us one more time before we, your website address is?
At Amy H, it's www.amyhsturgis.com, and links to all the publications I've mentioned, all the presses, and all the works that I've mentioned this evening are all there on the website, plus updates as to where I'll be speaking and signing and appearing. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Blessings to you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And coming up next is music. Music is coming up next here on KUCI. And since I'm not normally in this time slot, Kyle, what's coming up next?
Things that are square.
Namarie?